12 midnight Eastern Wartime, WEAF, New York. Good evening, everybody. This is Lyle Vann reporting from the NBC Newsroom in New York. The first 24 hours of invasion, history-making hours, have about run their course. It was 12:30 o'clock yesterday morning, Eastern Wartime, that the first Americans set foot on the rocky coast of France, followed 1 hour later by Canadian and British troops. Since then, amphibious and parachute troops have consolidated beachheads and positions along a 60-mile strip of coast between Le Havre and Cherbourg, have penetrated several miles inland from the sea in some places. The invasion is proceeding in a thoroughly satisfactory manner. A Navy man just back from the invasion coast says all main points have been gained. There's an air of unmistakable optimism at General Eisenhower's headquarters, wrinkled only by one factor, the threat of bad weather over the channel tonight. Reinforcements are being rushed to the Norman coast to strengthen the troops landed there already. But the channel is being whipped by a rising wind. The barometer is falling. It was bad weather that prevented the invasion thrust from starting 1 day sooner than it did. And now the unpredictable channel weatherman is acting up again. Satisfactory progress for our invasion forces is relayed from both German and Allied quarters. London says our invasion troops are making headway against opposition much weaker than expected. Allied casualties are much lighter than expected. President Roosevelt spoke to the nation by radio an hour or so ago, requested the people of America to join him in a prayer that the Allies may prevail over the enemy, that they may build a sure peace. He prefaced his prayer with a remark that our assault of liberation has met with success to this hour. Earlier in the day, at a news conference, the chief made reference to our naval losses, disclosed that 2 destroyers and 1 landing craft were the Allied naval losses to the first hours of invasion. 3 craft lost out of a total of more than 4,000 taking part. The German high command says fighting in the Cherbourg-Le Havre area is in full swing, that the Anglo-Americans are putting up a most tenacious resistance. Vichy radio, which is German-controlled, admits the Allied beachhead area has been considerably widened and Allied reinforcements are pouring in. A dispatch from London states a great force of RAF bombers left an East Coast airdrome in England tonight are streaming southward in one solid procession. More than 1,000 troop-carrying gliders took part in the early stages of the invasion. More Allied troops were dropped from planes by parachute. Overall, 11,000 planes of all descriptions took part in the greatest aerial operation the world has ever seen. There are indications tonight that the Germans are losing touch with some of their battle groups, that they're not sure where the main force of the Allied assault will strike. One German broadcast from Berlin, one for home consumption, said, "We do not want to report now on the hard fighting going on all over Normandy. We're fighting a tough enemy. It's not an easy job." British Ministry of Supplies says military power of the greatest magnitude is being employed by the Allies, including many secret weapons never before used. But by the time the sun was setting this evening, the Germans had not yet used their secret rocket guns, the ones that were supposed to have devastated southeast England. And the Germans say they expect new Allied landings along the coast of France, northward in the area of Boulogne and Calais. But the bad weather over the Channel augurs against such a move at this time. This vast military venture, far too big to picture at one glance, was made up of many component parts, hundreds of specialists and the machines of war doing their specific job, the sum total adding up to success in the first 24 hours of operations. Take the minesweepers, for example. They swept in first in the dark hours yesterday morning. Their job was to clear a path for the mighty fleet that was to follow. Converted fishing trawlers, coal burners, that served in the First World War, ships still on the secret list, these were the fleet of little boats that paved the way. They used sweep wires to tear loose the mines that barred the way to the French coast. There's no report of any of these gallant little craft being lost at this hour. They performed their tasks silently and efficiently. Behind them came the great battle wagons and their supporting warships. Each had their appointed task, an appointed target along that invasion strip. The gunners were assigned the most precise task, that of keeping their aim straight and true. 6 of Britain's battleships defied German coastal guns, sailed in close to wham salvos into German shore positions. At least 3 American battle wagons, the Nevada, the Texas, and the Arkansas, perhaps more, were there on the job too. The aim of these Allied gunners was very accurate indeed. Coast guns silenced before they had time to inflict any damage worth mentioning on the Allied fleet. British warships alone pour 2,000 tons of shells into the French coast every 10 minutes. 600 warships banging away at one time. What a great noise that must have been. And behind this cannonade came another group of specialists, the invasion craft themselves. This snub-nosed fleet was equipped with its own firepower, came in shooting in the wake of the job done by the Navy. The men who manned those invasion boats had a job to do, and they did it well. And the fighting men who took the rough ride across the channel to land on the beaches, why, the words of General Eisenhower's communique speaks eloquently enough of the job they've done. But let's pause a minute and consider the task assigned to our paratroopers. They were the first to hit the invasion coast. They flew over the hazards at sea, the hazards on the beaches, the hazards behind the beaches. They dropped down right in the middle of a hard-bitten, determined enemy, perhaps the most dangerous undertaking of all. There's been no detailed account of their fighting behind the front. They're battling in the region of Caen, 10 miles inland from the sea, and that point of resistance must be manned by our parachute troops tonight. Our amphibious forces haven't had time to drive that deep in from the landing beaches. Thousands upon thousands of paratroopers, both British and American, were dropped behind the Atlantic Wall. A spokesman at headquarters in London says he's not in a position to give out a detailed report of what has happened since they dropped from the sky. But they're armed with knives and Tommy guns, assigned to blow bridges, disrupt enemy transport lines, cause as much confusion as they can where it'll do the most good. Before taking off on their flight across the channel, they were wished Godspeed by the boss himself, General Ike Eisenhower, who spent 7 hours touring airdromes from which the air troops were to take off. And after chatting with the last of them, the boss climbed to a roof, watched the aerial procession as squadron after squadron flew off to the east. We know there was very little mishap to that paratroop armada while in the air. The big Dakota transport planes flew with running lights to keep formation, but met almost no opposition from the once-vaunted Luftwaffe. And perhaps one of the most colorful parts of the invasion is the story of the truly American Indians that took part. Indian parachute troops, composed of Yaqui and Cherokee tribesmen, shaved their heads down to a scalp lock, just as their forebears did in previous wars. The Indians were trained in demolition, carried 180 pounds of equipment on their backs, went into battle with red and black war paint on their faces. Included, too, in the paratroop division were a Hindu high diver, many daredevil automobile divers, former college athletes, brave men all, these paratroopers, and they're fighting somewhere ahead of the front lines on the French invasion coast tonight. It's only fair to speak of the airmen last. Not that our pilots and bombardiers have not done a daring and superb job, but because they've been in the news spotlight for many months now, doing the same kind of job they did last night and today. The thoroughness of their work can be read in the report tonight that enemy opposition is lighter than expected, that Allied casualties are lighter than expected, that the invasion operation is proceeding according to plan. And as Prime Minister Winston Churchill terms it, what a plan. They laid a carpet of bombs along the selected landing spots, combined with our naval gunners to dynamite a path through enemy fortifications. Our airmen flew in bad weather, rain, and poor visibility that the Luftwaffe dared not risk. All told, somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 Allied planes took to the air, opposed by a mere 50 German planes, almost 200 Allied planes to one German aircraft. Radio Berlin, monitored by NBC, gives this lame excuse for the Luftwaffe failing to come up and fight. Poor visibility. But it didn't keep our planes aground. There's little doubt, though, that Reich Marshal Hermann Goering will send his Luftwaffe against our invasion forces. He put himself on record with this statement today. The invasion must be crushed, even if it means the annihilation of the German Air Force. And we hope it does mean that. We have eyewitness reports, first-hand accounts of war reporters who went in with the troops. Ed Hawker of NBC flew over the invasion area in a reconnaissance plane, reported no German planes anywhere in sight. Howard Marshall of BBC went ashore with the first assault troops. He rode in one of the invasion craft, came back to London in clothes dripping from seawater. Here's his story. Our barge ran into a maze of anti-invasion spikes driven in the shallow water just out from the beaches. Spikes driven into the bottom with mines attached to the top. We hit one of them. The mine exploded with a great noise. A hole was blown in the bottom of our barge. But the men let down the ramp, and a Bren gun carrier drove out, fell into 5 feet of water. The men kept going toward the beaches. A second division of assault troops followed the one I was with. Soon the waves of troops had disappeared up over the beach. More followed in their wake, and the beachhead was established. There are many other eyewitness accounts, all giving pretty much the same picture. Beachheads nailed down with speed and dispatch. Beachmasters taking control in a jiffy, assigning weapons and supplies to assault units, the invasion rolling forward with very few hitches. The American troops who boarded their invasion craft in England last night seemed unaware that they were standing at the crossroads of history, that they were to help make that history. They jumped aboard with shaved heads, with $4 in invasion money, and right away, there were poker and crap games in progress, even while they were waiting to pull out for the big task. One American staff sergeant had hundreds of dollars worth of invasion currency, and he passed it off with this remark, "I like to travel heavy. There's lots of stuff I want to buy when I get over there." There's still a vast hidden army, waiting and ready to swing into action, the French underground. General de Gaulle has made a stirring appeal to that underground army of France, exhorted them to fight with all the means at their disposal to destroy the Germans. At this hour, that hidden fighting force is still waiting, instructed by General Eisenhower to hold its fire until the appointed signal is given. The Germans are well aware of this unseen menace. They've launched a campaign of threats promising dire penalty if any Frenchman is caught in the act of sabotage. But the people of France will be ready when the proper time is at hand. A glance at other war fronts, almost buried by the avalanche of reports from invasion headquarters. American planes took off from bases in Soviet Russia today, bombed German airdromes at Galati in Romania. Then they flew black to their Russian bases, the first American raid of the war from bases in Russian territory. Official Moscow reports the German offensive in Romania slackening after more than a week of attacks. And there are semi-official rumors in the Soviet capital that the grand summer offensive may soon be launched in the east to coincide with the Allied jump across the channel. In Yugoslavia, Marshal Tito says he's launched a new offensive, captured 6 towns in that Balkan nation. Down in the South Pacific, mopping up operations continue on Biak Island. But in Southeast Asia, American bombers smashed Bangkok, the capital of Thailand, with its heaviest blow of the war. J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, warns all police and other law enforcement bodies to be on the alert, to watch for any sign of sabotage now that the invasion is underway. Solemn ceremonies were in order at West Point today, graduation exercises for cadets of our military academy. And those ceremonies were interrupted by a thunderous round of applause as Cadet John Eisenhower stepped to the platform to receive his diploma. The son of the Allied invasion commander was commissioned a second lieutenant in the infantry, assigned to Fort Benning, Georgia, for advanced training. In a late dispatch from London, in the first news dispatch sent from the soil of France, Canadian press war correspondent Ross Monroe says that in 2 hours and 45 minutes of fighting, the Canadian invasion force had won its beachhead and shoved on inland. Monroe quotes the message the Canadian commander sent to Lieutenant General Creeder: "Beachhead taken, well on way to immediate objective." And here are some late bulletins picked up from the British radio by our monitors here in the NBC newsroom. The first German prisoners taken in the invasion operations have been landed in British ports. RAF pilots returning from low-level flights over the beachheads say the Allied forces appear to be doing very well, that there's no longer any sign of enemy opposition on the beaches. The Allies have already put up barrage balloons over captured sections of the French coast. Here at home, the nation marked the invasion report with silent prayer, the praying perhaps most noticeable in the nation's so-called gay spots. In New York City, war workers, shop workers, bankers all turned their thoughts to God in the great crisis. Mayor LaGuardia calls city employees and officials into his office at noon for a special service. The New York Stock Exchange halted activity for 2 minutes to beseech divine help for our invasion troops. Many thousands of New York shop girls were sent home after working a half day with instruction to pray and hope for victory. The nation's racetracks call off their programs in observance of the day. In all corners of the nation, all persons, and that means everyone who has a friend or relative in the great adventure, all paused and prayed consciously or unconsciously for its success. And at a port in South England late today, a minesweeper eased up to a dock just back from the invasion coast. No one cheered. There was a call for the medical corps. That minesweeper was bringing the first American wounded, the first American dead, back from the battle area. It's a reminder that the invasion, while being the greatest event of the war, is also a grim and deadly business. And the full deadliness will not be known until the great battles of the future are fought along the road to Berlin. This is Lyle Vann saying good night from the NBC newsroom in New York City. This is the National Broadcasting Company.